The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
There's a big difference between losing somebody, putting them in the grave, and then them just disappearing. You know, that's the thing, but not knowing is what's really terrible. There's just the uncertainty and the distrust. You know, you get to where you don't trust anybody anymore because you don't know who's involved.
In 1961, Sears Roebuck and Company organized a group of executives to find out where the company's goods and services were most needed and desired, what U.S. cities would be the most lucrative places to erect physical Sears stores. The subsidiary company was named Homart Development, and Sears Roebuck chief financial officer and all-around successful businessman Emery Williams was named president. Homart wasn't only looking to obtain land and build standalone Sears stores, though. The company sought to develop and retain ownership of shopping malls, modern, state-of-the-art shopping centers. About a year after the development company was formed, in January of 1962, building of Homart's first project was near completion, and the city of Fort Worth began scrambling to reconstruct area roads and highways surrounding it to accommodate the new mall, which would be called Seminary South Shopping Center. It was going to be the biggest and best in the area. W.K. Stripling, from the longtime Fort Worth business moguls, the Striplings, was the local contact for the project, and one of the area's largest builders, H.H. Franks, was hired for construction. Situated about 5 miles due south of the heart of downtown Fort Worth, the 85-acre site chosen for the project was the very spot Lake Katy had been only a couple years before. It was drained in 1959, all 50 million gallons of it, to make way for Sears and Roebuck's upcoming project. Local fishermen weren't too happy about it. Lake Katy, like most large bodies of water around the U.S., was the subject of their tall tales for decades. The catfish as big as small foreign car bit, and all that. But area businesses and shoppers were more than keen on the idea of a new mall. And on opening day, Wednesday, March 14, 1962, no one was disappointed. Although the unseasonably cold temperatures and even snowfall threatened Seminary South's christening, the event went off without a hitch. There was less of a turnout due to the weather, but business owners and officials were relieved, as they'd grown anxious about the event, thinking it would be a fiasco if the entire city of Fort Worth showed up. Anyway, the restaurants at Seminary South filled to capacity during lunch hours. Shoppers awed at the large fountains and the outdoor walkways. The parking lots surrounding the center, too, were as impressive as they could be, as if Seminary itself was a small island and the lot was the ocean, with the horizon the only thing to be seen beyond it. The clean, modern storefronts and the sheer variety of goods and services that the mall had to offer, seemingly everything, had the guests excited. The Homart Company had made a solid business decision, choosing Fort Worth as their first endeavor's home. For many years after, Seminary South was as popular a place for local kids as it was for their parents, and the shopping center solidified itself into Fort Worth culture. Just before Christmas of 1974, however, the shopping center became inextricably tied to the city's mythology for an entirely different reason. Three reasons, to be specific, that would from that day be thought of whenever any local heard the words, Seminary South, when three girls, Julie Mosley, Renee Wilson, and Rachel Tralisa vanished without a trace. If you're done binging that dark and riveting podcast you haven't been able to put down, and thinking of going down a rabbit hole to feed your already overwhelmed brain with every other tidbit you can find on the web, consider instead giving your noodle a rest with Best Fiends. If you're a regular listener, I'm sure you know by now how much I love Best Fiends, the challenging puzzle game I play when I need a break from writing, recording, or editing to get my mind out of the dark places. Apparently, I need a break often since I'm on level 2583. I clear a few levels here and there too when boredom has me antsy or on a coffee break at the dreaded and robotic day job. Best Fiends has it all. Bright colors, a rad little army of bugs and other small creatures you can collect, and it's totally casual. It allows me a break from the mundanities of the everyday routine and the sometimes overwhelming dark places that producing a true crime podcast takes me. Try Best Fiends for yourself. The puzzle game already has over 5,000 challenges, and new puzzles, events, and challenges are added all the time. With over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Mary Rachel Arnold, who went by her middle name, was born on November 15, 1957, to parents Francis and Raymond Cotton Arnold. She grew up with her older sister Deborah and younger brother Rusty in a South Fort Worth neighborhood and attended Southwest High School, where she was a junior in 1974. Folks described Rachel to us as happy, friendly, and compassionate. One friend recalled inviting Rachel to go swimming the summer of 74, but she didn't want to. Rachel had rescued a small kitten and was nursing it back to health with a bottle. After much prodding, Rachel finally relented and went with her friend to the pool, but instead of swimming with the others, she laid in the lounge chair poolside and fed the starving creature. That's not to say Rachel was all good girl. She was a teenager, after all.
She wasn't as innocent as everybody thinks she was. She'd sneak out of the window at night and go see her boyfriend, you know. I don't know what kid hadn't done that. But she was well on her way. She was doing well. She was just a great girl, you know.
She and her brother Rusty had a normal brother and sister relationship. There was indeed strife between the two, but he mostly remembers her as a caring sibling.
Rachel was a very sweet girl. She was a very happy, healthy kid. Her and I rarely had any disagreements or fights. We got along great. She made me mad a few times. I remember going in after she cleaned her bedroom one time and trashing her room. Just pissed me off. I don't know what about. It was so long ago. But I do remember doing that.
Rachel's life at the Arnold home was reportedly tumultuous for at least one reason we'll get back into on a later episode. But considering the fact that it was, the 17-year-old was likely thrilled to get out of her parents' house when she married Thomas Albert Tralisa in June of 1974, becoming Mary Rachel Tralisa. 22-year-old Thomas, or Tommy as everyone knew him, was freshly divorced and had a 2-year-old son from that marriage. He had inherited money the previous year, 1973, when his adoptive parents tragically died less than 2 months apart from one another. Tommy, however, couldn't touch the money he'd inherited till he was 30 years old, but he did maintain ownership of his family home on Minot Avenue in Fort Worth's Wedgwood neighborhood. The newlywed couple wasn't living large by any stretch of the imagination, but they were making it work. Tommy had a little money coming in monthly from some of his deceased parents' investments and was working for Rachel's father, Cotton, at his auto shop, Arnold's Transmission Service. Rachel was reportedly excited about the seemingly ready-made family. The home in the substantially nicer Wedgwood neighborhood was great, sure, but she was particularly excited about her new role as a stepmom. Rachel and Tommy were getting little Sean on Christmas Eve, and she wanted the boy's first holiday with her as his stepmother to go off without a hitch. There was one hitch, perhaps, in the Trelisa home. Deborah Arnold, Rachel's older 19-year-old sister, was living with the couple after a fallout with her boyfriend and roommate in Dallas over her not paying rent. She had dated Tommy Trelisa prior to he and Rachel's marriage. In fact, Deborah and Tommy had been engaged. Though a private investigator would later claim that Rachel was jealous of Deborah and Tommy, Deborah maintained that she and Tommy's engagement was never serious, and there was never any animosity between the three when they lived together. Regardless, Rachel is said to have adored Tommy's 2-year-old son, Sean, and her excitement only grew as Christmas approached. Many of the following accounts and details are not undeniably verified truths. As this story grew and became woven into the fabric of Fort Worth history throughout the years, confusion of exactly what happened to Rachel Trelisa, Julie Mosley, and Renee Wilson has mounted through retellings in which details, both slight and seemingly imperative, have become clouded and convoluted. Some details have been recollected differently by different people, and some have been recollected differently by the same people at different times throughout the years. Perhaps many of the events leading up to the disappearance of the Fort Worth missing trio won't help find them or make clear what happened to them, but perhaps it will. And there's a ton of misinformation out there, and even more uncertainties. Nonetheless, the following is our attempt at sifting through them. On the morning of Monday, December 23, 1974, at about 7 a.m., either Francis and Cotton Arnold, Rachel Trelisa's mother and father, or just Cotton, picked up Tommy Trelisa at he and Rachel's house on Minot Avenue to take him to work so Rachel would have the couple's only car, a gold 1972 Oldsmobile 98. According to Deborah Arnold, Rachel Trelisa woke her up and asked if she'd go shopping with her at Seminary South Shopping Center. Deborah told Rachel no. She'd worked the previous night at Gino's nightclub in Dallas and needed more sleep, Deborah later explained to a private detective. Some reports have Deborah up late playing canasta with Rachel until 4 a.m. that morning, however, and there's even another different story about the night before, and we'll get into both of those later. Either way, after Deborah declined to go shopping, Rachel left the house and headed over to her friend Renee Wilson's grandmother's house, where she had spent the night because Renee's aunt and uncle were visiting from Indianapolis. 14-year-old Lisa Renee Wilson, who, like Rachel, went by her middle name, was a couple grades behind Rachel, but the two, nevertheless, were good friends. Renee was born on August 29, 1960, to parents Richard and Judy. She and Rachel's families, the Wilsons and the Arnolds, knew each other and were friends, though they weren't necessarily as close as many reports would have you believe. Renee's father, Richard Wilson's closest friend, a man named Floyd Carter, lived next to Cotton and Francis Arnold, and through the years, as the Wilsons visited Richard's best friend, they became acquainted and friendly with the Arnolds. Though the families occasionally spent some time together at the lake, camping or boating, the closest bond that formed, without a doubt, was between Rachel and Renee. Mr. Wilson recently told us a little about that.
Her and Renee were good friends. She came around the house. At that time, we had some pigs down in Crowley, and we'd take turns going down there and feeding them, and Rachel would go down there with me and Renee on our nights to feed them. Rachel wanted to drive my pickup, and I let her drive it a little bit on the dirt road down there. I think that's where she learned to drive a stick shift. After she got married, I didn't see her that much. She was going to school. She had a house, a husband to keep up with, and go to school and all that. She had a pretty good job on her hands.
The Wilsons were a close and typical working-class family. Both Judy and Richard Wilson worked hard to provide for the family, but also made sure to stop and spend quality time with the kids often. Renee had a rivalrous relationship with her little brother Ricky, of course, normal stuff, but the two loved one another. According to her father, Renee Wilson was a good teenager.
She was in the pep squad at Southwest High School. She practiced a lot. She made fairly good grades. She spent a lot of time with her grandmother. She kind of liked to help her grandmother out because she was pretty old. And she had her little boyfriend that lived across the street, which was Terry Mosley. And she was friends with Terry, both of his sisters, and another little girl there. Yeah, her teenage life was pretty normal. She was had a lot of friends around our house over there.
Likely, Mr. and Mrs. Wilson at the time weren't privy to all Renee's extracurricular activities, such as smoking cigarettes on the roof over the garage at her grandmother's with friends, sometimes sitting up there and talking into the early morning hours. The way he talks about it, Renee's bad girl side seemed to be at least in part what attracted her boyfriend Terry Mosley to her. Though the Wilsons lived in the Rosemont neighborhood, when Renee was at her grandma's, she held her own down in Greenbrier. The working-class Greenbrier neighborhood naturally sculpted its latchkey kid denizens into rebels and thrill-seekers by the time they were teenagers, oftentimes before.
Oh, she could be nice and she could be mean. I can remember when we were young, I can remember fighting girls in the neighborhood. She was a tough girl. I watched her beat up a couple of girls right out there in her grandmother's front yard. But I don't know. She was pretty daring, fearless, seemed to me. But she wasn't wild. She wasn't a big party girl or anything like that. And she seemed perfectly happy.
Renee Wilson also babysat Terry's little sister, Julianne Mosley. Julie was born to parents Rayanne and John on April 5, 1965. When she and her siblings were young, their father left, and Rayanne struggled to provide for them. Life was never easy for the family, but Rayanne made it work. The Mosleys lived across the street from Renee Wilson's grandmother's house, and Renee watched 9-year-old Julie fairly regularly while her single mother was at work. Sometimes Renee would help her grandmother, Mrs. Swent, watch little Julie there, and sometimes she'd look after her at her own place. 14-year-old Renee even taught Julie how to roller skate in her family's driveway. She liked the kid and, by all indications, thought of her as a little sister. Julie looked up to Renee, the cool babysitter who was dating her brother. Julie was a normal and happy kid who did her best to hang around the older kids when they were around, Renee, her brother, and her sister's friends. But she was well-liked and had plenty of friends her own age, like Jackie, who remembers her as a thriving and happy child.
Julie lived in my neighborhood. She lived 3 streets up from me, and I met her at school. We both went to the same elementary school and were in the same class. And Julie was very close to her mom. She was the baby. I don't recall her ever mentioning any problems at home. She was a beautiful little girl. Nice, got along with everybody. She loved to draw, I remember that.
Her older sister, Janet, says you'd be hard-pressed to get Julie out of her cowboy boots. She wore them all the time, Janet said. Julie and her brother Terry, who was 15 years old in 1974, had the relationship you'd expect from siblings separated by 6 years.
We fought. You know, everybody does. You little kids. I grew up, we had our brother and sister thing. But, you know, I'd have protected her with my life. So, I mean, she was my baby sister. So.
Being attracted to the older kids, and because mom was at work, Julie was around on the morning of December 23rd as Rachel Trelisa pulled up to pick up Renee Wilson for their shopping trip to Seminary South, as were a handful of others, including Julie and Terry's sister, Janet, and Renee's close friend, Terry Ann. It's unclear whether or not Rachel and Renee had planned to go to Seminary South together that day prior to that morning. But Renee, anyway, had some jeans to get out of layaway at the local Army-Navy, a surplus and discount store that's a little tough to explain if you've never been to one. Army-Navy stores carried all kinds of goods, from survival knives to military surplus canteens to Dickie's work clothes, but most teenage kids at the time were more interested in the stylish but affordable hip-hugging bell-bottom jeans the store offered. That's what Renee was after that day. When young Julie Mosley caught wind of Renee and Rachel's planned trip to Seminary South Shopping Center, she naturally began begging to tag along. Terry Mosley told us the events of that morning the way he remembers them, including an event that makes his memory particularly vivid, presenting Renee with a promise ring.
I know I had bought this promise ring. I remember getting up early, and I don't know why I did it early. People have asked me, and I don't know why I got up and did it early. But Renee was at her grandmother's, and I went over there, and I think I woke her up, and I gave her the ring. And then I basically went back home, which is across the street. And I don't know if at that time, if she knew anything about a shopping trip or not, I knew anything. Maybe I did. But all I know is at the time that Rachel, later in the day, Rachel and Renee were in front of my house in Rachel's car. They wanted me to go shopping, and they wanted Janet to go shopping. And possibly our friend, Terry Ann, that lived in the neighborhood. I think they wanted all of us to go shopping. Normally, I would have probably went, but I got to thinking, there was two reasons I didn't go. One was that a friend that lived next door, another friend, he was going to go have a hernia operation that day. And I think he was kind of shook. He was only maybe 18. I think he was right, a little older than me. He was, maybe not even 18, 17. He was kind of shook up, I think, a little bit about having to go have this operation. So I told him that I would hang out at his house with him, which was next door to me, until he had to go to the hospital. And I told Renee I didn't want to go shopping, that because it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't like, we're going on this big shopping trip. The main thing I think they wanted to accomplish was Renee had jeans on layaway at Army-Navy, and she wanted to be sure and go get them out of layaway. And that's the first thing they did, as far as I know, after leaving my house. So it wasn't a big thing. So I decided I wouldn't go. I've told people, I got to thinking about it. I said, I was 15, almost 16, 15, and a boy, a male. I didn't really want to go shopping with a bunch of girls, I wanted to hang out with my buds. I didn't want to go on a shopping trip with a bunch of girls I didn't have any money. I know Julie didn't have any money. We didn't have any money, so there was no, I'll go buy this, there was no reason to go, so I decided to back out, and I wasn't going to go. But I know that Janet backed out to stay back with that other friend, Terry Ann, and that they were going to go and meet them at the mall later that day, like at noon or so. They were going to all meet up at the mall. Terry Ann didn't have a car. Janet was 11. Terry Ann was probably 13, maybe, something like that. Neither one of them could drive it. But Terry Ann's grandmother was going to take them and drop them off at Seminary South. So at the time when it happened, Renee and Rachel were in the car in front of my house trying to get us all to go. We were out in my front yard. Terry Ann, Janet, and I, possibly other people, but I can't swear to that. And Julie was there. And when we backed out, Julie said, I want to go. Well, I can tell you now, Rachel and Renee weren't real happy about a 9-year-old wanting to go with them. So they told her, if you can get your mom to say okay, you can go. Well, my mom was at work, so they had to call her at work. And so they had to get a hold of my mom somehow, at work, and then Julie had to beg my mom to go on this shopping trip. I know my mom wasn't going to let her go. She didn't have any money or anything, but she just begged and begged and begged. And so my mom said yes, which was really surprising to all of us. And since the girls had agreed that she could go if my mom would say yes, they let her go. So that's how it ended up being Julie and Renee and Rachel.
Julie Mosley, Renee Wilson, and Rachel Trelisa indeed made it to the Army-Navy store. Renee got her jeans, two pair, and even changed into one of them, leaving the other new pair and the pants she'd been wearing in the trunk of Rachel's 1972 Oldsmobile. A clerk at the Army-Navy, located on West Berry Street, about 2 miles north of Seminary South Shopping Center, later confirmed seeing the girls that morning. Renee had used the dressing room there to change into the new pair of hip huggers. The girls were never officially confirmed to be seen again, though there would be more reported sightings at Seminary South. Regardless, and presumably, Julie, Renee, and Rachel left the Army-Navy store and headed to Seminary South Shopping Center. Between them, it was reported, presumably meaning between Renee and Rachel, the girls had a total of $23. When Julie Mosley's sister Janet and her friend Terry Ann arrived at Seminary South to meet Rachel, Renee, and Julie at the Murphy's department store at noon, the three girls were nowhere to be found. It wasn't too much of a concern. Janet and Terry Ann just figured they'd forgot to meet them or got caught up doing something else. They went along their day, never running into Julie, Renee, or Rachel at the mall. Certainly, the three girls vanishing without so much of a trace was the farthest thing from their young minds. But that's exactly what happened. A little after 4 p.m., when Richard Wilson returned home from work, his wife Judy was there, but their daughter Renee was not. Judy Wilson told Richard she was worried. Renee had insisted, in quote, no uncertain terms, that she pick her up from her grandmother's at 4 p.m. sharp so she could get ready. Renee had a Christmas party to go to that night. She wouldn't have wanted to miss out on attending a party with her boyfriend Terry Mosley, especially considering he'd given her the promise ring that morning, though Mr. and Mrs. Wilson didn't know about that yet. Judy Wilson made a few calls but was unable to reach anyone who knew her daughter's whereabouts. She had Cotton and Francis Arnold's number, but she needed Tommy Trelisa's since she knew her daughter had gone with Rachel Trelisa earlier that day. Judy finally reached Deborah Arnold back at Rachel and Tommy's, who told her she hadn't seen the girls all day since that morning, and that Tommy had gone to the Wedgwood Bowling Alley for men's league night. Deborah phoned Tommy there. He wasn't too worried at that point. After all, he told us, thinking that your wife and friends were going to disappear, never to be seen again, wasn't a thought that came to his mind. Tommy just figured they'd gotten carried away with Christmas shopping. After making the calls, Judy and Richard Wilson headed up to Seminary South. Once there, Judy went into the stores, having the girls paged at the few stores that had that ability, and walking around others to see if she could spot them. Meanwhile, Terry Mosley was back at his friend's house.
I went over to my friend's house and sat with him until he went to the hospital. Well, our neighborhood was big, wide open. Everybody knew each other. Kids come and go. Kids at my house, kids at your house, kids everywhere. So for me, I stayed at his house. He and his girlfriend that were there, they left. I think I crashed out on his bed, either his bed or the couch. At his house, I just conked out, waiting on them to come back. And then I woke up, and I went home, and they still weren't back. And this was probably around 2 or so. And I was kind of like, well, when are they going to get here? But that led to, you know, getting later. Everybody got mad that they weren't back. You know, where are these girls at? And then it got later. And then it went from mad to out of our mind worrying. From what I in the beginning, when it first happened, like And everybody started searching for him, say at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. At one point, Richard and other people went looking for him. He's the one, him and some other people found the car at the mall. They're the ones that found the car. And that was probably about 6. Well, like I told people, back then, there's no cell phones or anything. So I was designated that for my family and my house, I was the one that had to sit by the phone. I didn't get to go searching or anything. I had to stay by the phone. Because if that phone rang, somebody needed to be there to pick it up. I mean, we didn't even have an answer machine. So that was my job that day, was to stay by the phone.
Back at Seminary South, Judy's brother-in-law had come up to help them look for Renee, Julie, and Rachel. The mall was packed. It was just 2 days before Christmas, after all, and he and Mr. Wilson split up and began looking for Rachel's 1972 gold Oldsmobile 98. At about 6:30 p.m., Judy's brother-in-law found it. The car was parked far from the shopping center itself, in the mall's east lot, outside Sears Department Store. Since Seminary South was incredibly busy that day, it was likely difficult to find a closer parking spot. The Oldsmobile was facing northeast. The car was locked tight. There were no signs that a struggle or foul play of any kind had occurred in or around it. Looking into the vehicle, the only things they could see was a single wrapped Christmas present sitting in the back floorboard and a couple school books in the back seat. Though a mall security officer came to check out the vehicle, Richard Wilson told us,
"We called the cops a couple of times, but they wouldn't come out until every store in that mall was closed."
That was an unfortunate delay, since the holiday shopping season had most of the stores staying open an hour and a half past their normal closing hours till 11 p.m. At some point not long after the car was found, Mr. Wilson had a thought come to him. An 18-year-old boy had recently been trying to date Renee, and Richard, well, Richard didn't like him. Mr. Wilson drove to his house.
And one time I drove down to a friend of theirs' house to see, because he had asked to go with Renee, and I told him not just no, but hell no. And I drove down to his house, and he wasn't home. I went back to the mall.
This guy will come up again, and in multiple, truly bizarre ways, but at this point, on December 23rd, 1974, Mr. Wilson headed back up to Seminary South. It was approaching 9:30 p.m., and the sun had long gone down. Still, no sign of the girls. At 11 p.m., when all the stores had closed, and Judy Wilson had exhausted her search of the mall, the Fort Worth police arrived at Seminary South's parking lot, where the car was parked. Now worried, he told us, Tommy Trelisa came up to the mall, too, at around that same time. Here's Mr. Trelisa on that.
I bowled that night. Got to bowling, come home, and they still weren't home. So I started getting worried, and David was getting worried. He went up to the mall. I think 11 o'clock. Somebody else found the car. And I'm at the place where the car was located, and I brought my spare set of keys, and, you know, we went to the car. The police went to the car and stuff.
Tommy brought his spare set of keys, and the vehicle was looked through for any clues that might lead to Julie, Renee, and Rachel's whereabouts, or at least where they had been. But there was nothing except Rachel's old jeans and one pair of new ones in the trunk, the present in the backseat floorboard, and the school books in the back seat. Contrary to common misinformation, repeated over and over by the press, there was only the one present in the 72 Oldsmobile, and it had come from Renee's grandmother, Mrs. Swint, a gift for Rachel Trelisa's 2.5-year-old stepson, Sean. The car provided only the one clue to their movements that day, Renee's hip huggers. It was easily ascertained that the girls had made it to the Army-Navy store, but absolutely nothing in the vehicle that suggested they'd been inside the mall. Tommy and Deborah were the only other family members Richard Wilson remembers seeing at Seminary South that evening, though Rusty Arnold, who was 11 years old at the time, along with he and Rachel Trelisa's mother, Frances, remember searching the shopping center that day. Later, when Seminary South and its parking lot was clear of cars and souls, the search party, too, went home to make calls and brainstorm the next move. Everyone, that is, except Richard Wilson and his best friend, Floyd Carter.
When the store closed up, I carried my wife home and went over on 6th Avenue and picked a friend of mine up. We were closer than brothers, Floyd Carter. And me and him set up there. It was Sears Automotive Garage. It had like three or four garage bays, and I was sitting in front of one of those bays, the last one on the north end of the building, where we could watch that car. But I was sitting in there, and I had an eyeball right at that car. Nobody came near that car. I did not see no security guards drive by it. I did not see no security guards driving around there. Because if they had been around there, they would have come and made me move. And it was just me and Floyd Carter.
Mr. Wilson's account disproves at least one other supposed sighting of Rachel, Renee, and Julie. But we're not there yet. There have been seemingly endless reports that either add or take away details printed in the newspapers, told to police and private detectives, and, in more recent years, posted on social media, and hardly any seem to be totally verifiable. Here's one example. Years after this day, decades in fact, Tommy Trelisa's first wife, Shauna, told a private detective that she saw Rachel, Renee, and Julie that day between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. when she came to pick up her and Tommy's 2.5-year-old son. She was pulling in as the girls were pulling out, Shauna said, and upon seeing her arrive, Rachel stopped and pulled back up the driveway. Rachel, Renee, and Julie got out of the car. Rachel got little Sean out, and they all went inside, where everyone but Rachel waited in the den as Rachel collected Sean's things. There are, however, several questions about this account. Terry Mosley has always maintained that Sean was not with Rachel when she came to get Julie. The presence of a 2-year-old isn't an easy detail to overlook, so Terry's word and the fact that no one else saw the boy there seems to contradict Shauna's statement. And that's not the only thing. In Shauna's account, she specifically mentions everyone putting on their sweaters and coats after Rachel had collected Sean's belongings and they readied to leave. But the temperature on Monday, December 23rd, 1974, was unseasonably warm. Tied for a record, in fact. The temperature during the window of time Shauna claims this exchange took place was 69 degrees Fahrenheit at 11 a.m., climbing all the way up to 76 degrees at 1 p.m. Unless things were vastly different in 1974 than in my time growing up in the area, no one was wearing sweaters and coats to go out in those temperatures. The private investigator who took the statement makes no mention of these discrepancies. Pointing this out isn't to say Shauna purposefully lied or falsified anything, only that the recollection seems implausible. However, taking into consideration that the statement holds some semblance of truth, and at least, perhaps, some details are accurate, which is necessary, it should be noted that Shauna said she saw no one else in or around the home during her time there. No other people and no other cars at the residence. Shauna said she did not see the girls leave. Perhaps the encounter happened earlier than Shauna remembered, when the temperatures were a bit cooler and coats and sweaters were necessary. But still, the lowest temperature that day was 65. It seems unlikely the girls were wearing warm clothes. It's important to note, too, that Tommy Trelisa also told us that he thinks they had little Sean and that he was picked up on the morning of the 23rd. Regardless, Julianne Mosley, Lisa Renee Wilson, and Mary Rachel Trelisa have not been seen since that day, Monday, December 23rd, 1974. Or, at least, have not been confirmed to have been seen since that day. In the days following the disappearances, Fort Worth police treated the case as nothing more than a bunch of kids running away. All the girls, however, were excited about Christmas, particularly 9-year-old Julie. And Julie was excited about returning to school, too, her friend Jackie told us, because her teacher was reading the class the books The Boxcar Children and had left the kids on a cliffhanger when she dismissed class for the holiday break. 14-year-old Renee was excited about the party that night, demanding her mother not be late to pick her up, and had reportedly just gotten serious with her boyfriend. 17-year-old Rachel was thrilled about stacking underneath the Christmas tree toys for her stepson, 2.5-year-old Sean. They didn't run away, and that's about all the time we'll give to that theory. The police, in their lack of concern, didn't even dust the Oldsmobile for fingerprints before turning it back over to Tommy Trelisa the day after it was found. Renee, Julie, and Rachel became known as the missing trio over the years, and their disappearances are steeped so heavily in mystery that the girl's story has become embedded into Fort Worth culture and legend, spurring wildly unlikely conspiracy-type theories and endless, truly endless, rumor, speculation, and vitriol. But considering the letter that was discovered the following day, on Tuesday, December 24th, 1974, the only piece of physical evidence in the history of the case, and the confusion it continues to cause to this day, the chaos surrounding Julie, Rachel, and Renee's disappearance seems inevitable. If that's what the letter was written for, the writer did a hell of a job. It even had the cops holding their heads high with their little runaway theory. We'll start from the letter on the next episode of Gone Cold, clearing up at least one detail of it, or at least the envelope it supposedly came in, once and for all. And perhaps we'll add to the long list of questions about it that already exists. There's a lot more to come in the following weeks about the missing trio. Much of it is information we've dug up that I've never heard associated with the case, some of it common knowledge that we feel needs a closer look, and even more that veers a little off course, or perhaps a lot off course, but this is stuff I feel is relevant and should be explored. As of now, I plan to release a few smaller episodes in between the regular episodes to deal with specific topics. Please bear with me. If you have any information about the disappearances of Mary Rachel Trelisa, Lisa Renee Wilson, or Julianne Mosley, please contact the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. There are a ton of folks who've helped us along the way. Kelly Arnold, Sherry McReynolds, Judy Burns, Jana Roberts, Linda Trelisa, Janet Mosley Hensley, Terry Ann Shepherd Stembridge, Terry Ann, Wanda McCaslin, and so many others. We'd like to thank everybody at Missing Fort Worth Trio on Facebook. Special thanks to those who contributed directly to this episode: Richard Wilson, Terry Mosley, Rusty Arnold, Thomas Trelisa, and Jackie Jones. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or perhaps help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company to their database. We'll provide a link in the show notes. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as The Devil of West Texas, and our latest there, The House of Horrors, among others. Thanks to all y'all who support us there, it means the world to us. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Dallas Morning News, were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.